Welcome to PhotoActive, a podcast about photography and technology. I'm Kirk McElhern.
And I'm Jeff Carlson.
You can find show notes, including any photos we discuss in this episode, at photoactive.co. That's photoactive.co. So we were planning a deep dive into the photo editing skills of Kate Middleton. But we realized it's probably not worth a deep dive. If you haven't been reading the news, so we're recording this on the 12th of March, 3 days before the Ides of March, 5 days before St. Patrick's Day. If you haven't been reading the news the past couple of days, Kate Middleton, she's some princess here in the UK. She released a photo of her with her three children, and a couple hours after, a bunch of news agencies said, kill that photo. Don't distribute it. Take it offline. Because, well, apparently it had been doctored.
Oh, no.
And for about 2 days, there was no response from the palace. And then Kate Middleton came out on her Instagram account. She actually has an Instagram account, the only royal, I believe, who does, or at least the only senior royal, as they call here, the senior working royal, as they call
it. Okay, good distinction.
And she apologized for her somewhat amateurist photo editing skills. She likes to play with photo editing, blah, blah, blah. She's known to be interested in photography. Lots of photo websites have articles about her because they get clicks. Here's her with her Canon, whatever. Here's her with her Fuji, whatever. And she takes pictures and it's not new. We were discussing before we started recording, we were planning a 4-episode series about this, but it's probably only worth about 2 minutes. My takeaway is that this is not a press photo, and it doesn't matter if it's been slightly photoshopped. It's not a photo of an event. It's a family picture. I think there's a lot of overreaction here, but some of that overreaction is due to the fact that she was in the hospital, then she's been out for a couple of weeks, and no one knows if she's alive. So this was – people were waiting for like a proof of life photo. Someone should Photoshop a picture of her holding up a newspaper with a date to make sure that she really took this after she came out of the hospital.
Well, and also I believe this was also posted on Mother's Day in the UK. So right. And I mean, it's a photo of her and her kids, and they're smiling. Like, it totally looks like a family snapshot. And if you weren't scrutinizing it the way they scrutinize everything in the UK when it comes to the royal family, you wouldn't even notice. I mean, honestly, I saw a few posts and they had like little areas circled, and I was just trying to figure out, because they made it sound like, well, it's so obvious, and they were like, oh, it's AI that did this, and then someone looked at the metadata. And I mean, it's ridiculous, because I think what happened is she was using an older version of Photoshop and did the thing that everybody does with family photos, is you take a bunch of photos, especially if there are multiple people, especially if there are multiple small children, and then there's the ability to merge those so that you have a shot that has everybody smiling. And it's not going to be perfect, and that's fine. And I think just because she is who she is, and because of all this drama around her, that's why suddenly the news agencies were like, well, we can't run this because it's a journalistic malpractice. And, you know, we've talked about the high bar for journalism, and that still applies. This wasn't journalism. This was a snapshot. They could have easily just said, this is a photo taken and edited by the princess, and that would be it.
Well, actually, the credit went to Prince William, who was either holding the camera or pressed the button because the camera was on a tripod,
right, okay,
or something like that. So he gets credit for taking the photo, but she's the one who did the editing. But you make an interesting point. I didn't know that Photoshop had that thing to merge faces. Android phones do that now.
Yeah.
So if you take a few group photos, it's going to find the faces where everyone's looking and no one's caught blinking, and it's going to merge them. So does that mean if you're taking photos of an event, let's say a protest, with an Android phone, and you accidentally leave that feature on, and you're a journalist, and you submit a photo like that, no one may know actually that it was on if it's done well enough? So does that mean that you've created a journalistic sin? What if you take a photo with an iPhone and it does 13,000 teraflops per image or whatever, and it takes 9 images and puts them together? That is in some ways manipulated.
Yeah. I think that and of course the crazy thing is that lots and lots of journalism outlets nowadays in the US, I guess, probably everywhere, like, they're just expecting their reporters to take pictures with their phones. I know that there was a big push for TV journalists. They're like, well, we're not going to send a two-person camera team with you. You have a phone. It'll record video. It's just for the nightly news. Just while you're there, set it up on a tripod and do the selfie thing.
No, not even. Get one of those things with the suction cup on the back and stick it on a window.
Perfect.
So you can shoot yourself without even needing a tripod.
Yeah, it's all – it's crazy. When I first saw this, as someone who has written about these kind of features, it drove me crazy. But also, the royal family is just like a weird other news sphere. I don't quite get it, and I'm kind of glad that I don't quite get it.
You're lucky. I mean, I live here and it's just I don't care.
It's anyway. Insane. So
okay, so we actually have a real topic we want to talk about. And your notes for this, you had written down primed by seeing or primed for seeing. I'm not sure what it was. So this grew out of a discussion we had, I think after we recorded our last episode. Someone asked on Facebook, how do you develop the creativity to take interesting photos? And it's an interesting question because you're not born with a photographic eye. The photographic eye is educated. And I think this is the same about any sort of art. To appreciate any kind of art, whether it's music or books or literature or even pop music, you're educated to like Taylor Swift or the Beatles or both or neither, right? But with photography, it's different because we see photos all the time, even badly edited photos of the British royal family. And these kind of sink in our mind, these images. We did an episode a while back where we talked about all the bad photos I see in Facebook groups. And it's over and over in street photography. If someone looking at a phone, it's like, dude, wake up. We're tired of seeing phones. If you did this in 2007, it would have been interesting. It's not anymore. You're overwhelmed with photos. You see them in advertisements. You see them in magazines. You see them on TV. You see them everywhere. So in order to see good photos, to learn what it takes to make good photos, you have to make a lot of effort. And there's several ways to do that. We're going to talk about it. As any regular listener knows, I'm a big fan of photo books, and I have a lot of photo books, and they're very heavy. If you ever want to move a bookcase with photo books and you take all the books out, you can hurt yourself.
I dread the day that you move. If that happens, I hope you hire movers because I don't want to hear
Kirk. Oh, I do.
Kirk threw his back all to hell because he had photo books. Sorry.
The last time I moved, the mover said they had never seen so many books, just all books altogether. Now, to be fair, there's a lot of people who have more books than me. I mean, who read more than me and have bigger libraries. Anyway, photo books for me are, I want to say it's a recreation. Some photo books you can almost look at like they're telling a story if the way that they're laid out is such. Some are collections of photos. But when I start looking at a photo book, my mind shifts into, how can I say, a kind of a receptive, a mode receptive to creativity, receptive to art. Because I'm looking at these photo books because I consider the photos to be art. I think there's an intentionality. If you're just looking at The Guardian, every day they have a page of 20 interesting photos, and these are press photos, so they're events. Some might be portraits. It's not necessarily art. You'll see some wonderful composition in these photos. You'll see catching moments, not too many people looking at their phones, but it's not really art. When you're looking at a photo book and you're thinking these photos are art, you're looking at it in a different way, and you're opening yourself up to that internal question, what is art?
So I have two things that have popped to mind based on this. The intentionality, I think, is key. And it's not just looking at a photo book with intentionality. I find that when I'm looking at photo books, it's not just, oh, what makes this a good photo? But it's that idea of, why do other people think that this is a good photo? Because this is something that, especially with, I mean, street photography is a really good example, partially because there's so much of it that's not good. But then you run into something that is good, or you run into something that somebody says is good, and you're looking at it, and you might be thinking, well, yeah, that's composed well, or maybe it captures a spontaneous moment, right? I know we've mentioned this before, but who did the photo of the man jumping over the puddle?
That was Cartier-Bresson. It's a very famous photo of the a gentleman jumping over a photo by, I believe it was a Gare Saint-Lazare, the Gare du Nord in Paris.
Okay. I was actually going to say Bresson, and then I was like, no, that'd be too obvious. Okay, so if you look at that image, it's not focused very well. It's kind of blown out. There are so many things, quote,
it's blurry.
It's blurry. There are so many things that are quote unquote wrong with that photo, and yet it persists. And there's a question of, does it persist because it was taken a long time ago when you didn't have as much of this? But then again, why would we then still think it's a good photo? And so there's that tension that I find when I'm looking at something that is expected to be a good photo and I don't get it, or I am searching for the reason why this is highly regarded. So that's one part of it. And I think that's a very good example of the type of thinking and the type of questioning that you need to bring when you're looking at photos like this, rather than just, hey, look, there's a picture of a building and a person. And oh my gosh, is that person really holding a cell phone? Amazing. But the other part of it, I think, and is a big part of maybe the underlying problem, is that when you're talking about music and movies and like paintings, things like that, these are things that we're not seeing every day. With so much of photography, this is the world that we see every day. This is that problem of you can go and make amazing photos in your own backyard. But for me especially, I find it really difficult because I know my backyard. And so it's not as interesting to me, and it takes a lot of extra effort for me to try to get into that mindset of how can I be looking at this differently? Maybe I'm just looking at where the light is, or I'm just looking at maybe something that has changed. But it takes effort, and it takes a very conscious application of effort to see in this different way. And I think people just get stuck on that.
Okay, so two things that came to mind while you were talking about your two things that came to mind. The first is there is definitely a weight of history in any form of art, and you will get – it's hard to not appreciate a piece of art that's been appreciated for a long time, and particularly with photography that – I mean, it was born in the 19th century, but it came of age once the portable camera, the Leica, came around, and – that period, the 30s and the 40s and 50s, is it's kind of the early history of photography that we know. So this is the kind of photography that has been shown as exemplars for good photography. I think on an absolute level, that is a wonderful photo because you're catching something at the arc of the man's legs, and it shows movement and it freezes something. But there will be photos that will be 50, 100 years old that now are starting to look, well, maybe it's not that good. So the question is, yes, why do people like it? There are some people who will go and talk about the golden ratio and the Fibonacci sequence and put spirals over photos. It's like if you were a painter and you could compose your painting using those things, that's understandable. When you're a photographer, you can't compose. You can compose by, I like to say, you compose a photograph by determining where the four corners of the frame are, but you can't move elements around unless you're shooting in a studio. If you're out in the world, it's what's there. And just saying, oh, it's because it's the Fibonacci sequence and the spiral and, you know, the Illuminati or whatever. that's like putting an interpretation on top of a photograph. The second thing about going into familiar spaces is, Marcel Proust said something to the effect of the real wonder in the world is to see the world through someone else's eyes, right? We're so used to seeing what we see that it's almost invisible. You go out in your backyard, I go out in my garden, it's the same. You don't notice things. So what you need is to be primed to see differently. See, I did that really well. And seeing is different from looking. Looking is passive. Seeing is looking into things. It's seeing the nature of things. It's It's seeing what things are, what they could be, what they have been, what they will be. It's not just looking at a rose as a rose. It's looking at a rose and imagining it was a bud and then it flowered and then it's going to wilt. It's seeing something that goes beyond. And I think it's that, and I think you used the word in our last episode, the ineffable of photography, that is hard to find, but that can be cultivated. And ask me how.
How? Tell me how.
Look at photo books. So
where did that come from?
My example that I like to
cite. I had no idea that was coming.
My example that I like to cite. So if you look at Ansel Adams' photos of the Rockies and you go out in Seattle, you're not going to make photos like Ansel Adams. It's not going to help you frame what you see, mm-hmm. right? If you then go to the Rockies, instead, you might be inspired by that. You need to look at photos that are roughly what you live or where you're going to shoot photos. My best example is William Eggleston. A lot of people will think he's boring as heck. But if you get to know his photos and spend a bunch of time looking at his photos, for me, I go outside and I look at the world sort of through William Eggleston's eyes. And I can see the kind of things. This is why he chose to photograph something that looks like this, which actually is boring, but when you look into it, nothing is boring. It's there's a way he has in his photos of capturing things. He liked to look at photos upside down after they were printed. He didn't do any of his own printing. He didn't edit photos. He didn't crop them. He didn't do anything. He liked to look at them upside down and see if they worked because he felt that there was an abstraction in photos that was necessary. But not everyone's going to agree with that. You might not think the landscape should be abstract. You might not think portraits should be abstract, but the kind of photos he did, this is what he felt. And the more you look at photos like that, the more you internalize the ideas that that photographer had in composition. And again, where are the four corners of the frame? And as you see things, as you look around outside, you might stop and say, okay, that might work.
Mm. So I wonder how much of that is also style. And this may be sort of going a little bit further afield, but if you have somebody like Eggleston who sees the world in a certain way or sees his photos in a certain way, then that's sort of self-perpetuating because that's how he sees the world.
That's his style.
Yeah. And so many people are obsessed with trying to figure out what their style is. And I think unless you're being super deliberate that my style is going to be urban settings with low saturation.
People looking like at phones.
People looking at phones. Then, you know, that's sort of like a, I don't know, a style that you're forcing on yourself. And I want to just sort of put that off to the side because I don't think that's really what we're talking about. But having that look, having that way of vision for Eggleston then gives you the freedom to see things. No, that doesn't make any sense.
No, it does make sense. It's his style.
His style.
If you like that style –
okay.
You can inspire yourself from it. Good artists copy, great artists steal. Is that what Picasso said? Something like that? It's not that you're making Eggleston photos. It's that you're taking Eggleston's concepts and you're applying them to photos and they're going through your own personal filter.
Right.
And Eggleston's just one example. If you don't like Eggleston, then look at someone else. I like Michael Kenna's minimalist photos. I can't really shoot them. A lot of them are long exposures. Mm-hmm. But if I'm out in a field and there's trees, I kind of, ooh, that's a Michael Kenna tree type photo. And I would think of that. I don't know that I have a particular style personally. I don't take as many photos as you. I'm tend to be more deliberate, but I am interested in that minimalist style. I am interested in that, I want to say, non-figurative style of photos. And the more photo books you look at, the more styles you'll discover, and some will resonate and some won't. And then you take the ones that resonate and you use them as templates when you go out looking for photos.
Yes. So a quick question for you. If you're looking at your photo book library, would you say it is mostly representative of the type of shooting of like Eggleston and that?
Not at all. Okay. No. I've tried to buy books by a number of photographers. I have a five-volume set of Gordon Parks. He was a black photographer who shot a lot in the South, a lot of civil rights stuff. I have Bruce Davidson. I have Joel Meyerowitz. I have more Michael Kenna and Eggleston books than anyone else, but I have a wide variety of photo books. I've got Martin Parr books. I mean, Martin Parr is like the ultimate street photography of people doing strange things, right?
Yeah.
So, no, I don't limit myself in the books I buy because I want to see what other photographers do, particularly who are the great photographers, right? Yeah. I knew a bit about Gordon Parks, and then I found this five-volume set of his embarrassingly cheap on Amazon, like less than 100 pounds or something. And it's like a 400-pound set normally. And I bought it. And it's wonderful to look through that. And they're historical photos at the same time. But no, my library is quite broad.
Okay. So part of the reason I ask is that sense of if you are – immersing yourself in a particular style, then perhaps you will go out in the world and see that style. Now, let's move this away from photo books into, say, how can I, as someone who does not have a vast photo book library, slowly building, but, you know, average person who does not, what do you do? And I think there's such an inclination for a lot of photographers to go somewhere and see what they find, which is a big part of photography. I mean, it's that discovery, right? I'm going to go to a place I've never been to before, or maybe I'm going to go shoot a landscape on a morning where it's supposed to be dramatic clouds and all of that. And you go and you open yourself up to the experience and you look and see what's there. And I think that's a part of it. But when you're talking about priming yourself, that's where a bit of research goes in, a little bit of scanning to see what other photos have been taken in this place. And, you know, that can be done on Glass or Instagram or, you know, all sorts of places where you would have some dedicated photography. And even if you run up against pictures that are not going to be very good, and I guarantee you will find pictures that are not very good – that will give you an idea of what to shoot while you're there. Maybe everybody is at this one spot. Like, for example, at Yosemite National Park, there's a little pullout where you come through a tunnel and you park and you can just see the whole valley. And it's gorgeous. And I guarantee everyone listening to this has seen a picture taken from that spot. However, you see that, but you also see the different times of the year and different conditions. And so there are some absolutely amazing photos out there from this spot because the clouds were rolling through the mountains and there was mist on the trees, or it was a whole lot of water coming off the waterfalls, all of these various things. When you prime yourself to see what's possible there, when you get there, you're not just starting from scratch. You're not just saying, all right, I step out of my car and what have we got here? Looks like there's a road and I should probably not fall down that embankment. You know, like you don't have to start from scratch and think of it as, well, I just have to purify my mind so that I'm not affected by any outside things so that I can make this amazing original composition. Because most likely what you're going to do is not going to be that great. So I think this is what really appealed to me when we were talking about priming, is not just photo books, but doing some research, seeing what other people have done, and then take that shot that other people have done and then build on that and look around for other compositions. Look and see what the light's doing behind you. All of those extra things that make the photography process interesting and exciting as you're doing it.
I'm going to suggest that when you get out of the car and don't fall down the embankment, that you don't take out your camera right away, that you sit and you look and you see and you appreciate and you try to feel it instead of immediately putting your camera up to your eye and shooting, because That's the killer that just gets rid of the creativity. That's the snapshot reflex. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be in a place to shoot particular a particular site, you need to take your time to feel that site. And maybe the clouds are moving by and you're going to get the rhythm of the clouds and you'll know when to shoot a picture. Maybe a bird's going to fly by and you'll – but take your time. Don't rush into things.
Here's the advantage to that is that your eyes are going to see so much more than your camera lens. So if you just immediately frame the scene with your camera, then you're just not seeing everything else around you. So –
yep.
Yeah, seeing, not just – wait, looking. Yes. I almost said seeing, not just visioning. No, that's not right. Seeing, not just looking.
Yes. No, but I think the point is interesting, to spend time in a place, letting your eyes wander. I interviewed someone on one of my podcasts recently, and he's a productivity author. He was talking about a technique that – you get up in the morning and you sit down with a notebook and a pencil and you stare at a wall for 15 minutes. The idea is that you're not looking at a phone. You're not being overwhelmed with – you're letting your subconscious come forth. And you could stare out a window. Like here, if I was upstairs, I could be looking out over the wheat field across from me. And you get that freedom when you're looking over a large space, right? And that idea of getting to a place and just sitting and not doing anything, just letting your mind wander a bit. Look at what's around. Just you get attracted by some light here, some movement there, and take your time. It's very rare that you're going to run out of time to take a photo unless you're like just before golden hour or you want to catch the sunset in a particular place. It's very rare that you don't have the time. So it's more interesting to take that time to try and see what is really there and not what you can just like grasp at a first glance.
Absolutely. And that works because you have primed yourself to be in that location.
Boom.
Yay, we solved photography again.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people do ask the question, how can I take good photos? So we'll link in the show notes to the episode where we went through the photo book, which is a poor title for a photo book. It's called The Photo Book, not very good for SEO, which has a few hundred different photos by different photographers. And one of the suggestions we made was if you find a photographer who looks interesting, look up more of their work. Look on the internet. You'll find more. There's so much out there, and it's so – it's overwhelming. It is. It's overwhelming. And don't take photos like Kate Middleton, or if you do, don't use cheap Photoshop features and edit them and stuff like that. Do we have any snapshots
actually,
this week, Jeff?
I think the lesson is don't be British royalty. That's probably
– don't be British royalty. Eat the royals.
Eat the royals and eat the rich in the US.
Okay. Do we have snapshots?
My snapshot is actually something that I no longer have, but I wanted to point people to it. For DP Review, I got the opportunity to shoot a Leica SL3, which means I have now joined your cult of people who have made photos using a Leica.
Not only that, but you've also shot with a Hasselblad
recently.
And a
Hasselblad.
And you're getting to shoot with all the great cameras, which is wonderful because I can imagine that each time you pick up one of those new cameras, you're seeing things differently through the camera because it's a different
absolutely,
camera.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's not just a different camera. It's a completely different resolution, different way of shooting. We'll link to the Hasselblad episode as an example of having a different mindset to shooting photos. But in this case, this was the Leica SL3 that was just recently announced, and it is the – I would say it's sort of the workhorse camera of the Leica line. This is what people who are, I believe, more studio photographers who want to shoot Leica, who have a lot of Leica glass, what they're going to use. It's a 60-megapixel sensor. It's slightly smaller, slightly lighter than the previous SL2. It's got in-body image stabilization and actually some neat Wi-Fi features. And what was interesting in terms of my experience is that the way DP Review works is my editor called me and said, hey, would you be willing to shoot a camera that's not been released yet? And of course, I said yes because they will also pay me to do so. And the idea was to shoot a sample gallery, so 50 or so photos that show all aspects of the camera, how it works under different ISOs, fast, dark, bright, like all the situations you can think of. But originally I was only going to have it for 4 days, and they only gave one lens with it. So it was just a 190 millimeter prime, which is an interesting focal length, not really ideal for a broad situation. So I ended up spending 2 weeks with it because they kept pushing out the deadline because the Leica rep was in Germany, because that's where Leica's from. And it was a really interesting, good experience shooting something that's very high-end. It's an $8,000 camera body, but also just having hands-on with another system. One of the things that I'll mention about this especially, and it doesn't seem like a big deal, but it kind of is that the interface has been redone compared to the previous model, and it's really nice.
You mean the menus?
The menus, yeah. Yeah, the menus and the shooting interface a little bit, like if you're using the touchscreen to change some of the settings and stuff. They're using a new font and new icons, and it just felt like a very clear shooting experience from that point. And I would love to see more camera manufacturers put more time into that aspect of navigating the camera, not just shooting the camera. All right, Kirk, what do you have this week?
Well, coincidentally, I started reading, or actually listening to, a book that fits in with today's topic. I didn't think this was our topic today when we started. I forgot that we were planning something else, and that got delayed. And so this is a book that was published last year by Rick Rubin. It's called The Creative Act, A Way of Being. Rick Rubin is a record producer. He's notable for having produced rap, but also for having brought back Johnny Cash in the last few years of his life to make some incredible recordings. And this is a book. It's about creating. It's about, I want to say, it gets a bit touchy-feely for some people, but it really resonates with me because a lot of his ideas match kind of what I was saying before about photography, about seeing and all that. There are short chapters. I believe the print book's about 400-odd pages. The audiobook's 6 hours, so it's not very long. I think it's short chapters with large fonts. I'm looking at the Kindle supplement right now. I want to read just two paragraphs from the end of the first section. It's little sections of maybe a few hundred words each. To live as an artist is a way of being in the world, a way of perceiving, a practice of paying attention, refining our sensitivity to tune in to the more subtle notes, looking for what draws us in and what pushes us away, noticing what feeling tones arise and where they lead. Attuned choice by attuned choice, your entire life is a form of self-expression. You exist as a creative being in a creative universe, a singular work of art. And this goes directly to what we were saying about looking and seeing and trying to find things. And I listened to about a half an hour this afternoon before we started, again, not thinking that we were going to discuss this topic. And I think that whether you're a professional artist or an amateur or whatever, there's an awful lot to learn here. I think this is a book to read and reread. There have been a lot of books, sort of general creativity like that. And they all do get a bit, I don't want to say a bit, and they all get a bit sort of toward the spiritual, and he's very clear about that he is, but there's something about the way he's saying things that could resonate with any type of creativity. It is Rick Rubin's The Creative Act, A Way of Being. And if you do listen to audiobooks, he's got a really good deep voice. Sorry, my throat's a bit scratchy. I can't do the Rick Rubin voice, but he's got one of those, almost a Johnny Cash deep voice.
Oh, nice. So basically, you were primed for our episode today. Perfect.
I was primed for priming today, and you were shooting with a prime on your Leica. So it all comes together.
It all comes together. And with that...
with that, until next time, Jeff.
Until next time.
Thanks for listening to Photoactive. You can find show notes, including any photos we discuss in this episode, at photoactive.co. That's photoactive.co. We couldn't afford the M. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/ PhotoActiveCast. That's PhotoActiveCast in one word. You can subscribe to PhotoActive in your favorite podcast app or on Apple Podcasts. See the links on our website. And think about leaving us a rating or review in iTunes or in your podcast.